So I'm very, very honored to have as our guest today a very longtime old friend and colleague, Sandy Close from Pacific News Service and New America Media, who actually gave me my first job in journalism nearly 30 years ago. Sandy is a graduate of the University of California, Berkeley. She began her journalism career in Hong Kong in the mid-1960s as China editor of the Far Eastern Economic Review, a magazine that, much like The Economist, you might be familiar with, it covers the Far East. After returning to the United States, she founded The Flatlands, an inner-city newspaper in Oakland, California, and spent 5 years writing about prison and criminal justice issues before joining Pacific News Service, where she's been the executive director since 1974. Under her leadership, Pacific News Service has helped launch the careers of, it says here, a generation, but I think it may be several generations of young, talented reporters who often focus on individuals and communities and issues on the margins of society, speaking from the silences of our society. She, in the 1990s, helped create Yo, a magazine, Youth Outlook, a monthly magazine written by and about young people. In the 90s, she co-founded The Beat Within, a weekly writing journal by incarcerated youth. That same year, she founded New California Media, which became New America Media, which is now the largest editorial and marketing collaboration of ethnic media in the United States, distributing news stories and commentaries to some 3,000 partners in the ethnic media, newspapers, radio, and television programs. She's received a MacArthur Foundation Genius Award, recognizing the importance of this work and the great journalism prizes that George Polk Career Award, and just last year from the Nieman Foundation for Journalism at Harvard, the I.F. Stone Medal for Journalistic Independence. Please join me in welcoming Sandy Close. And I promised Sandy I would embarrass her and maybe myself a little bit by recounting, for the benefit of all of you, that one of my great memories as a young journalist is turning in stories to Sandy from reporting in the outback of Nevada and places like that, and really having to deal with the really tough editing, a very strong point of view that Sandy, really great editors, and Sandy is one of the great editors of our times, has a strong point of view that loves nothing more than to trust young writers to tell their stories, to go out and find the story, to tell it like it is, and to come back and surprise her. But then that goes through a pretty intense editing process of conversation about how that fits in with what we think and know about the world. And I remember many times going through this process and getting off the phone and going down and lying down on the couch and pulling on my hair and having a good cry, and then getting up the next morning and going back and working at it again hard, and then looking back after 10 or 20 years at some of those stories. And some of those most difficult stories, I think, are some of the stories that I'm most proud of. So, I wanted to share that with you all who are in that position of turning in your work and recognizing that it's a long process, and sometimes the most hard things are the most important things that you can do. And I've watched as Pacific News Service has become New America Media, and we have continued to talk and collaborate over the years and think about things that we might be able to do with students here at UCLA, and working, as we've talked about over the course of the quarter, working with the diverse community and ethnic media here in Los Angeles and California and elsewhere. And I wonder, Sandy, if we could start with, if you could tell something of the story of the creation of New America Media and why.
Or how it got started.
How would a
journalist who, by the age of 45, had lost most of the language skills, which I never really had in any great, to any great extent, but I knew some Mandarin, I knew Cantonese better, I knew a little Vietnamese because I spent a lot of time during the war reporting in Vietnam. And languages you learn in the 60s, probably French was considered the cosmopolitan language as opposed to Spanish and French. But I had lost those languages, and there I was, a mainstream newspaper syndicate editor. The daily newspapers of the time had a great idea of what they wanted to do. And it's important to remember that because we kind of talk about mainstream media as a kind of has-been that didn't fulfill its promise. In fact, the idea that was really exciting was to connect you to the city around you. It was to give you a sense of how you connected to the rest of the population that lived in the city. It was really an intimate experience to pick up the daily newspaper, and it still is for me, and have a cup of coffee and feel yourself understanding the larger community of people who populated the environment around you. And that was meaningful. It wasn't called the news, it was called the Chronicle. It was called the Times. It breathed life into the city around it, and the city around it breathed life into it. So that idea of mainstream, which got a bad rap because as populations grew more diverse and it became less diverse, it couldn't fulfill that original promise. And I think living in San Francisco, running a news service that was headquartered in California, where the second largest city by the mid-90s was Tijuana, where the influence on fashion in San Francisco was more likely to be Manila and Shanghai than London or Paris. Where I thought of us at the, not the westernmost point of Europe, but the easternmost point of the Orient. To not know what was in the media that was being consumed by the populations around me, and to not be able to access what their thinking was, what their experiences were, what day-to-day life was like for them, through the mainstream media, which had, that was its original mission, really weighed on me. And one day, my husband, who was a scholar of China, read an editorial from a Chinese language daily, one of them. There were four at that time in San Francisco. And it was an editorial urging people in the audience to vote against a proposition that would have required a mandatory sentence of life for three strikes. And this was a paper based in Taiwan, considered very conservative. And here was this editorial urging the largest ethnic population in San Francisco, Chinese, who by then had a majority of Chinese-speaking immigrants as opposed to American-born people in the city, urging them, and you know how it urged them? It quoted Confucius. and it said the single most important thing you need to teach a child growing up is a sense of remorse. If you lock somebody up for life, how will they ever learn to have a sense of remorse? Whether you agreed or disagreed, if you come from that tradition of wanting to make sense out of the community around you, wanting to connect people to each other so that the city you lived in, really, you could feel a relationship to it. You would want people to know that the Chinese language media was urging voters to vote against this proposition that ultimately won, but lost among the Asian vote in San Francisco. That would be something you'd want in the news, right? So I decided, you know, I'm going to give a lunch for the editors of ethnic news publications in San Francisco and see if they'd be willing to give us more of the stories like this so we can do a better job to explain what some of the critical voices are saying in these communities. It was 1996. So we had a Chinese lunch because a Chinese restaurant had round tables. And that was very conducive to connecting people to each other. And if you have a long rectangular table, you know how hard it is to talk from one end to the other. Much more intimate, even if you have three round tables. Because suddenly the word went out and all the ethnic media folks wanted to come. So we had 24 people who came to a restaurant called Harbor Village. And the lunch lasted 2 hours and started with people going around the room introducing themselves. And I'm Alex Esclamada, I'm from Philippine News. I'm Tim Lau, I'm from the Tsingtao. I'm Gail Berkeley, I'm from the Berkeley Post, a black newspaper in Oakland, despite the name, etc. The Korean newspapers, the Russian newspaper, some Thai newspapers, and Vietnamese papers. And as we were going around the room, the Philippine editor, when he stood up, he said, you know what? If you add up our circulations, we reach more people than the Chronicle, the San Francisco Chronicle, and the Examiner combined. And there was this amazing sense of excitement because all of these media had been very isolated in their own cultural silos. And the sense that they might collectively begin to get recognition for the work they were doing, and a sense of being part of the journalism community was so exciting to them that I still remember it to this day. And it repeats every time we bring ethnic media, whether it's Albuquerque, Memphis, Miami, Houston, New York. There is this sense, and as you saw it at the awards Thursday night at KPCC, this sense of excitement at being acknowledged for the important reporting work people do and for building a new communications architecture. Imagine if you could share the content of Chinese media reporting in the black press. Imagine if black stories from The Wave or The Sentinel began to appear in Lao Pinyon, and if stories from Lao Pinyon began to appear in the Korean paper. That was the vision some 16 years ago that ignited this sense of excitement. It was nothing I was smart enough to have planned. It simply emerged. And everywhere we've gone now in the country, it's repeated itself. And it's very simple to understand. You've had a tremendous growth in the 90s and the noughts of this media sector. It's been around forever. The first black newspaper was called Freedom Journal. It probably wasn't the first. It's the one that we know of. It was in New York. It had a larger circulation than what was then a German language newspaper that had a larger circulation than the English language circulation. Okay? It was very, very big. And its mission statement was this: we wish to plead our own cause. Too long have others spoken for us. How often have you felt watching the news, well, they think that, but what about me? What about my peer group? What about all of us who are in the thick of this? We don't get our voices heard. So ethnic media grew out of that impulse to have a collective voice in the public discourse, which they felt, and you can understand why, mainstream media could not, even though it wanted to, in the best of circumstances, could not deliver. So ethnic media grew up for a very strong felt need. And as immigrant populations grew, so too they brought ethnic media with them. They created the need for demand for ethnic media, and it emerged. If you look worldwide, there are easily 250 million immigrants, people who are considered global migrants worldwide. What would you say the percentage of that number is women?
It's 60.
It is actually over 50%, which if you think about the way we discuss immigration in America, it's almost invariably the male. It's always sort of perceived as a male experience. In fact, half of immigrants in the United States today are women, and over half of the world's migrants are women. And more the women who are moving alone, not simply with family. It's a very interesting phenomenon. You see all over the south of the United States, which began to feel the impact of people coming in from overseas, from Latin America, and moved to the south because there were job opportunities. So too, you saw the biggest growth in ethnic media in places like Atlanta, Georgia. So you had 14 Korean language news outlets in Atlanta in 2009, 14, imagine that. A tremendous diversification and a great resource for those of us wanting to work in the field of media and communications, because as this combined audience grows, it becomes so important. In California, as you know, if it wasn't for ethnic minority, and our words confound us, if it wasn't for Asian, Hispanic, and Latin American voters, we would be a red state. We would be a Republican state. It is these populations which turned California, traditionally a Republican president and governor electing state, into a blue state. It is these populations that passed Prop 30 in 2012. The white Anglo voters were Republican and were against Prop 30. So the swing vote, if you will now, the driver in California politics has become the ethnic voter. And you see the importance of reaching these audiences. And you also will find, if you look on our website, the polling we've done nationally in multiple languages to measure the audiences of ethnic media. And the audience of ethnic media in our last poll was 57 million ethnic adults. That's one out of four adults in the United States who identify an ethnic news outlet that they regularly access. So it is definitely not a footnote. It definitely is challenged by having been isolated from a lot of the academic academic resources. As late as several years ago, there was only one school in California, one university, that offered a course in Spanish language media, and that was Cal State Northridge. Jose Luis Benavides teaching there. Now it is beginning to enter some of the journalism curriculum. But it's a very distinctive genre of journalism, and I'll just say, finally, that first lunch showed this tremendous hunger, not only to be more visible, not only to have validation for their role in journalism, but to work collectively to achieve it. And the Vietnamese publisher and the Spanish language publisher sitting next to each other at that lunch, I still remember the conversation. The Hispanic editor said, "What's it like to be Vietnamese in a Spanish predominant city?" And the Spanish editor, and the Vietnamese editor talked a little, I don't remember what he said, but the Spanish editor said, "Could I publish that?" And it was this desire to be visible in each other's communities that really inspired me. If you can look at a community today and understand how important it is, when you hear the Spanish being spoken from the restaurant, of the kitchen of the Thai restaurant, you are meeting constantly with people speaking languages that I don't even recognize. Armenian is Greek to me. I wouldn't recognize it. Or Slovenian, or all these languages. How important it is for these media to know each other, to collaborate together, because if and when they work together on joint stories, and share content and transcend the community they target in a way that really reflects the complexity of the lives you are living, then they begin to really meet their mandate to inform their audiences about the city around them. So,
and what you've, the New American Media, you have, I think, pioneered in here in California and elsewhere. I'm thinking particularly though here in California of multilingual polling, and of doing polling that has enough of a sample of each of the different language communities to be statistically sound, even in those segments of the larger poll. And what if you could talk about what you found about people's attitudes toward the environment, and then what the significance of that is for the coverage and the interest in the environment among the ethnic media.
Sure. When you hear the word public, what do you think? Sort of, you think of all of us, right? You think of the public. Actually, the word comes from Greek, the word polis. And the ancient Greeks thought of public as a very exclusive term. Women and slaves were not allowed in the polis. They were called idios. So public was a pretty special arena to belong to participate in. So when you hear the word public opinion polling, always ask yourself, what public are they polling? And in a state like California, up until 2010, the polls of voters were exclusively English-speaking. And as you know, California has 40% population that speaks languages other than English at home. So how exclusive were the public opinion conclusions that we were getting. We began in 2002 to do multilingual polling, and now quickly a lot of public opinion polling, fortunately, like the Public Policy Institute of California and the Field Poll, began to do Spanish language polling. But you didn't get Asian language polling in representative samples to tell you what Chinese thought versus Filipinos versus Asian Indians. And just think, are Koreans, let alone smaller population groups. So you had African-American, Spanish, and the rest of us in public opinion polling. But that word public, you have to be careful about how you use. The public thinks, the public feels. And I remember listening to an NPR report right after, about 6 months after September 11th, and it reported on the public polling showing what Americans felt about the threat posed by Muslim terrorists. And of course, it was only in English. And we had actually begun by then to do national polling in multiple languages, which showed very different, not always different, but significant differences. And again, it's that important fact that in our country, if we have a robust public discourse, it's got to be as inclusive and true to that vision. You want to know what different communities think in order to really make sure. I mean, I learned a lot from Confucius the day that I still remember the editorial about the importance of teaching remorse. So public opinion polling in California on environmental concerns, environmental attitudes of Californians. For the last several years, the Public Policy Institute of California has found that Asian, Hispanic, and African-American respondents feel more strongly about the need for government regulation to address climate change than non-Hispanic whites. They feel more strongly that climate change could impact the prosperity of California than non-Hispanic whites. It is not across the board, and I'll give you one example. Koreans surveyed were less concerned about air pollution than non-Hispanic whites, which a Korean editor explained to me with a question, have you ever lived in Seoul? You know what the air pollution is like in Seoul compared to Los Angeles or San Francisco. So it would make sense if you ranked that of less concern by comparison to your life in Korea. Air pollution didn't seem that big a problem. But it is, I think, significant for this reason, and it really gets to why I wanted to come and meet you guys today. The ethnic media, like all the journalists you've heard from, will tell you right up front, we are doing more with less. We had to cut back our newsrooms. Even Univision, the giant in the television space, whose audiences dwarf now those of general market network television news, had to cut a third of its reporting staffs in 2010 because the recession and the impact on the advertising, and now I hate to think what the sequester is going to do to government advertising. Government is the 20th biggest advertiser in the country. And for a sector, a media sector, that has long been the footnote, the last to be thought of in terms of an ad-buy, even for Prop 30 and 32 in 2012 in the November elections, we got a request to run advertising 3 weeks before the election. They waited until the very end to say, uh-oh, maybe we better advertise in ethnic media, right? When you look at all that, you've got editors who really know their audiences care deeply, and the reporters working in these media care deeply about environmental issues. But compared to having to cover the school board, compared to having to cover home country politics or events in the community, they have to cover everything, and the environment is an ongoing story that they don't, frankly, know how to cover as well as they'd like, and the result is they go to what they know and do and can produce the content on. So there is a huge demand and there is a huge need. And supposing, for example, we could get a number of you to do a couple of things, like John has already told me about a couple of essays some of you have written, and I immediately thought, gee, I know ethnic media that would love to publish that, that would be really interested in that. But what if we were to do an inventory of the birds of Los Angeles and what's happening to different bird populations? Not because we're all fascinated with birds, although many of us are, but because it's an indicator. It's the canary in the coal mine kind of indicator. It tells you more things about the environment. And what if we were to begin to tell stories of people who've come driven by environmental problems in their own countries to Los Angeles? They have stories to tell as environmental refugees, but they also have wisdom to impart about how they're adapting here with this more profound sense of the impact environment can have on everyday life. You can't just turn on the air conditioner and think about it when you're comfortable. You will have to integrate it into your everyday life. How do you do that? Who are some of the people in communities that are not maybe members of the Sierra Club, but the Sierra Club would probably love to know what wisdom they brought about living in a city where space is now ever smaller. In San Francisco, the apartments that are designed now to accommodate the new population coming in to work in technology is like probably no bigger than your bathroom. And it's not designed for family, by the way. It's not family-centric. It's young, upwardly mobile, career, techie, professional-centric. Not a bad thing to be, but it's definitely how does a family live and make a home out of a very small space? That's something you could all benefit from knowing. So there are a lot of stories that you might not even realize are stories that you need to sharpen your observational skills and begin to develop a ability to discover and share those stories that I think ethnic media in the Southern California area would probably love to access. And at the very least, they would love to access the perspectives and experiences of the younger generation, because ethnic media serve an older demographic. And as that demographic ages, they want to be relevant to the next generation. So you are actually in the catbird seat. You have an interest in the environment. you have an interest in learning communication skills, and you are a demographic that is very appealing to, I think, media. You live complicated lives that transcend the particular cultural experience of your parents' generation.
So I know you all will have questions for Sandy, and I bet she'll have some for you too. So let's open that up.
My name is Kim, and my question was this. Given that many ethnic minorities and immigrant communities are often less affluent than other communities, do you believe that ethnic environmental media can create lasting behavioral changes when these changes might not be necessarily immediately economically feasible?
Give me an example of an environmental change that you're thinking about.
Like implementing or replacing your toilet with a lower flow toilet where the immediate cost is a lot more expensive than the long term, or is more expensive than the immediate savings. Or solar panels as well. Just like more expensive things, or perhaps eating from a more locally based and organic place instead of getting like McDonald's all the time, stuff like that.
No, that's, I'm really interested, and I can't give you a kind of systemic informed answer to that. But you see, that's what makes journalism such a great craft. You start with something you don't know. You're in awe of what you don't know. Every day you get up in the morning and you say, geez, look at that story, I wonder why. And that becomes the passion, the direction giver for a journalist. You want to discover the answer to that. A colleague of mine who used to work for us and now works for the New America Foundation, Lisa Marganelli, did a fascinating study last year on the impact of car ownership and gasoline prices on average household incomes. She isolated it in California to the point where she could demonstrate that more money was being spent on gasoline and maintenance of the car than on healthcare. That more money was being spent at times than mortgage, and that car ownership was a factor as gasoline prices went up in foreclosures. Isn't that interesting? And I immediately thought that we always hear about options for renewable energy, and conservation is sort of never one of them. We hear about solar, we hear about thermal, we hear about wind, and now shale, but we don't hear what if everybody lived frugally the way most of the rest of the world does, unless oil and we cut our energy use. And California has actually been ahead of the rest of the country in keeping our energy demand flat, but it is still so exorbitant compared to everyone else. I'm one of the great offenders because I travel, and I'm guilt-ridden as a Catholic. I think to myself, oh my God, I'm using up, carbon footprint and the gasoline, but I don't know what to do about it, because if I stop being visible, we wouldn't be able, as a nonprofit, to raise money. How could we handle this? So we're in a torque situation that's hard to unknot. I would just suggest to you the great thing about your question is that it leads to so many more questions rather than a definitive answer. I was telling John about a column in today's New York Times by David Brooks, which says, forget energy conservation, we're moving into a new century thanks to gas and shale and this explosive new production of natural gas that's made the United States on its way to becoming a bigger energy supplier than Saudi Arabia. That it's going to be a century, a second century of America preeminence because we'll be energy independent. Now that's, how many of you thought, what would the world be like if we weren't running out of energy, right? What would it be like if we suddenly, now isn't that interesting? So it whether he's right or wrong, what's fascinating is the pursuit of what you, of being able to ask the question. I would just say to you, John, that I remember a young woman who came to my office, and she had just graduated with an MA in journalism. And the problem is the journalism school convinced her that she knew stuff. She finished my sentence before I had finished it with a new question, as if she knew what I was actually going to say. Oh, I want to work for you because you're progressive. What makes you think I'm progressive? Well, you believe in abortion. I said, actually, I'm a Catholic. I don't believe in abortion. And I realized she had lost, she had somehow been made to feel that her job was to frame the story, to find the soundbite that would demonstrate the story she wanted to tell. So you know what I assigned her? We had 9 days of rain. 9 days of rain in San Francisco is unusual. So I said, I want you to do a story about the rain. What do you want me to do? I said, I want you to go and talk to homeless people and find out what they do with when it rains for 9 days. And she looked at me as if I was crazy. And I said, if you don't learn something from those interviews that you didn't know, you asked the wrong questions. The key to really being for going into journalism, and it's not, I'm not saying it's the be all end all thing, I'm saying for someone like myself who loves learning, it's to let yourself have the luxury of being curious, of not knowing, of being in awe of what you don't know. And then realizing the key is to be able to use those questions to engage people who might never have thought that they had something important to say. So the young woman is in juvenile hall. And she doesn't want to write that night. All of our workshops are volunteer. You don't have to go there. But of course, it's a captive audience. They have nothing better to do. So they're apt to come. But she didn't want to write. She didn't want to have anything to do with it. Why don't you want to write, I asked. And she was irritated. She said, because I'm depressed. Why are you depressed? And she was even more irritated. You just don't get it. You don't know. Tell me, I really want to know. She said, I'm depressed because I'm in a room locked up. Do you know what it's like to be in a locked room? And I had her there. I said, no, I don't. Tell me what it's like to live in a locked room. And she said, writing, as if she were writing. She said, you sit on the bed, they shut the door, they lock it, they turn out the light, you look at the wall, you watch an ant crawling up the wall, it disappears, you're alone. And I have not forgotten that young woman's story, although she told it to me maybe 6 years ago. I've thought about it almost every day. I learned what communications could be. It's so much of it is listening. So much of it is letting the person know, as that young woman who came to see me didn't let me know. I really want to hear what they think. Really want to learn from what they have experienced. And that will give you, that's the best lesson I can share with you about journalism. So any other questions?
Hi, my name is Jennifer. Along with ethnic groups, do you also work with religious groups?
With what?
With religious groups. You mentioned that you're Catholic. Religious?
The legitimate?
With religious groups.
Oh, with religious media.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. You know, it's your laptop that was blocking out. I couldn't hear what you said.
Yeah.
Definitely. So one of the winners on Thursday night, if you read the script, works for the Jewish Bulletin.
Okay.
And another winner works for the Final Call, which is an African-American Muslim publication. So definitely, religion is one of the ethnically defined groups that would basically have to say, we work with LGBT media. We have a pretty loose and expansive kind of view of what ethnic media are, but it pretty much would be aimed at a particular group. Now, what's happening with your generation is that you see the evolution of the children of ethnic media. And in areas of California like Richmond, outside of San Francisco, where the big Chevron plant is very heavily polluted, very poor city, by and large, predominantly African-American, but increasingly Hispanic, with also a large Southeast Asian refugee presence, Nguyen, Hmong, particularly from Laos. This city, like Coachella, the eastern Coachella Valley, like South Kern, where, I don't know if any of you are from South Kern, but you have towns like Laverne and Weed Patch, that are pretty rural, where people will tell you the biggest public safety issue is bands of chihuahuas that have been left behind by people from foreclosure, and they've become feral chihuahuas. And you have, these are just fascinating for somebody as parochial as I am, who lives just in San Francisco. It is great to begin to learn about and connect to these other communities. We have begun to see young people start community media that are essentially serving people who have no homegrown media left of their own. I call them media deserts. And you can say these are children of ethnic media, the next generation of ethnic media, because they're very much about community. They're not about what you would find on the internet with blogs, which are my opinion. I think of it as the authority of I, the single pronoun. Ethnic media are the we. We wish to plead our own cause, very much a community view, with all of the limitations of that. Because as you know, your peer group can be very sensorial. It can limit your freedom, but it can also be empowering. So it has its pluses and minuses. So these media are growing up like Coachella Unincorporated, or the Richmond Pulse, or the South Kern Soul, or Silicon Valley Debug, which was started by people, young people, on the assembly lines of Hewlett Packard and other computer manufacturers that figured they weren't getting any voice in the Silicon Valley discourse. So they started their own publication called Silicon Valley Debug. Debug is what you say when you're on the assembly line and there's a problem, and you debug it, you fix it. These media are very interesting to me because if you take the Richmond Pulse, it's run by an African-American, it's in Spanish and English, and it aims at the whole city of Richmond. So it's not ethnically defined, and that's true of all of this new generation of ethnic media. It's usually run by someone of color, not always. It is young people from very underserved communities which have communication skills, not producing youth voice, not producing youth media, but producing community media to make sense out of the city around them. So I think of it as a 19th century publisher reborn in the 21st century. Very interesting. So these media are something, I think, they're media that would be very interested in anything you guys might be interested in doing individually or collectively as well. We have one in Long Beach, which is probably our closest, but there's another one in Boyle Heights.
And you came from I know earlier today, a meeting with Southern California Edison, and we were talking earlier also about, you know, companies like PG&E or Southern California Edison. Many of the students here in class are environmental science students and students from all other kinds of disciplines across campus, and may not. Some are journalists, but not all, and may not go on to have, you know, think about careers in journalism or in writing, but will be and are very interested in communications. And I wonder, you know, why it may end up in companies like Southern California Edison or PG&E or other kinds of companies, and why are those companies so interested in ethnic media?
You know, I'll answer that with kind of a story that the newspaper I've long read first is the Wall Street Journal. The Wall Street Journal is primarily a business paper, or has been, and as a business, it's interested in the market. What is the market? The market is ordinary people buying. Ordinary people whose habits and likes and dislikes have a tremendous effect on what business decides to do. You can say, well, maybe they're all just, you know, following the dictates of advertising. But the Wall Street Journal, for a long time, understood that if it could do reporting about the market, that meant they had the best story on a day in the life of a day laborer, a story about where Japanese get their sense of humor. It's almost like they were the anthropological newspaper, and the New York Times was more the newspaper of record that told you what the public institutions and the people working in the public institutions, the polis, the influencers, were thinking and doing. So what I like about these companies is when they really recognize their future depends on being able to communicate effectively with their market, they have a tremendous need for people who are effective communicators. The problem, of course, is, I don't want to sugarcoat it, that we know that corporate dollars, in the end, are going to sometimes really dictate what a communications team is supposed to say and not to say. So I don't want to say, oh, go and work for Southern Cal Edison because it will help you advance your communications career. It may get you a very good job in PR. But I have to say this, those two utilities were much more diverse, had hired many more people of color, many more immigrant workers, long before my profession, the Chronicle, the San Francisco Chronicle, or the mainstream media, or the new nonprofit media has done. They're far more diverse. And why? Because they had to understand their audience. They had to understand the market they served. They were translating their websites long before the government translated its website into multiple languages. How do you make sure? Last summer, we did briefings with ethnic media in for Southern Calasin. You know why? Because a family, an African American family in San Bernardino, had been in a storm, an electric storm, and the father had gone out because one of the lines, the transmissions, fell, and he touched it. And his wife came out afterwards because she saw that he was electrocuted, and she touched him. And then the son came out. The entire family died. They didn't know how to handle electricity in an emergency situation. And you know what? As somebody born in New York and lived most of my life in cities, I didn't either. So Southern Cal Edison wanted us to communicate very simple emergency messaging to ethnic media. I respected them for that. It made me very loyal to them. And they also, as you may know, the San Onofre nuclear power plant, they had installed new equipment, two new units went online, and two of the three units had a problem, they had to shut it down. And I talked to them and suggested that we do an ethnic media briefing where they could tell ethnic media what was happening with San Onofre. Don't do what happened in Japan. Don't clam up and sort of become a fortress with information. At least get out information so people can understand what's going on in the plant, what are the units, what really happened, and what are you doing about it, even if you don't know how it's all going to work out. And they did that. So I can't say that I've changed the culture of a major utility in the United States. I will say I gave them the benefit of the doubt. And I would, if somebody said to me, well, I'm thinking of a career working in corporate communications, I'd definitely recommend Southern Cal Edison. But like with mainstream media, like with all media, like in any job, it's what you make of it.
I was going to do a conference here. Do you mainstream news organizations, I didn't say mainstream, they are embracing the depth and difference of news culture, I'd say, and they're hiring more ethnic minority staff and changing their focus and their outlook and content. And to represent ethnic minorities, you know, immigrants, young people, I think it's slowly changing. So have you had any feeling that your project and ethnic-centered media, these thousands of ethnic news outlets, are slowly becoming less and less different to mainstream media just with time?
The wish is that that is the case. I think what we want is not ethnic media, mainstream media, new media. We want inclusive media. Instead of niche, sub-niche, micro-niche, you'd like to feel... You're always going to have niche media. You're always going to have somebody really wants to know everything they can get their hands on about motorcycles or about ultimate fighting or whatever. I mean, sports, if you look at it, has, unlike most other things in news media, grown. You've noticed that, right? If you want the best sociology in America, read the sports pages and then read the obituary pages. But the reality is that the American Society of Newspaper Editors shows diversity has taken a huge hit in mainstream media since the recession. So it's last hired, first fired, and the cutbacks have made mainstream media less diverse than it was in 2009, 2008. The newsrooms are less diverse. And I've noticed with new media, new nonprofit media, similar situation where you have a lot of people who've gone from mainstream media to new media, and they've got to do a really good job with grants. And they're new at the nonprofit game, right? What are they going to do? They've got to really show they can deliver. So they hire their best friend who just got a Pulitzer. Or they hire the person they worked with at the old media. So the new media staffs tend to be also not diverse, very Anglo, non-Hispanic Anglo, white. Does that mean that they can't do a good job? No. But I'll give you one example of what's happening. And it troubles me because I want as much media as we can get. Ford Foundation gave $1 million to the Los Angeles Times. For a major foundation to give a large grant to a commercial media enterprise was newsworthy. It gave it to the Times so they could expand their coverage and hire diverse people. This is 2012 we're talking about. They could hire people who were culturally fluent in the communities they felt needed to have more coverage. Now, I actually hired a very good friend of mine who ran the largest Vietnamese daily in the country. And she is now at the LA Times. She's a very good reporter. Did they invest a similar amount of money in the media that served the ethnic communities? No, they didn't put a dime into that. So you had an either-or situation, which is unfortunate because you need the both and. I love the LA Times. I love print. Sorry, I'm addicted to print. I'm glad that the LA Times got the funding. I'm sorry that it wasn't paired with an investment in ethnic media at this point in time. Now, what's happening overall, I think, is that media that's able to address the complexity of your life, which is far more complex than the life I grew up in. What are the job realities you're facing if robots are now in Silicon Valley actually replacing waiters and waitresses to take your order in swank restaurants? If you're wiping out entry-level jobs for your generation, which we used to do stories called Waiting on Dreams, young people who wanted to become actors or become doctors or artists or singers. Paula West, a great jazz singer, was a waitress for 13 years while she got her feet into it. If they're eliminating those jobs, I'm just using this as an example, your life becomes very complicated because that was overwhelmingly an entry-level job for a lot of people. And of course, the racial and demographic changes you're growing up in, you're way ahead of the curve. You're not living the reality of most of the people running ethnic media that they grew up in. You're way beyond those experiences. So the media that captures the complexity of your life, that's the media. I would say KoreaAM does a very good job of it. I would say, there are some, India Currents does a very good job of it. There are some tremendous news outlets that 10 years from now, if you want to know, what was Silicon Valley like in the 2010, go back and read India Currents. It's like reading Jane Austen to know what that period was like, what Victorian England was like. There are wonderful literary traditions. So I would say first to you that we want more collaboration. We want the lines between these media blurring, which is why we did the awards at KPCC. We wanted to go right into mainstream media. We want to do stories that leverage the strength of ethnic media to enrich the content of general market media. And we want the reporting skills, the investigative journalism, the computer-assisted reporting knowledge of excellent mainstream journalists to improve the quality of ethnic media. So ultimately, yes, I think the vision is an AP of ethnic media is going to the same end you're saying. It's we want to know about each other.
And what would you, I mean, if what would you like to see change about how we communicate about the environment within that inclusive vision? And what is it that the media that you work with want or need to be able to communicate better about the environment?
I think the ethnic media want to be able to tell the stories of their communities as they're impacted by the issues of climate change, as they become actors in their own right in addressing environmental issues. Their understanding of environment, is that even the word they use for the challenges that we think of as environmental challenges? Maybe they can give us language. We're stuck with language that's very out of date. It doesn't always describe the reality we see around us. Look at me using the word ethnic. I mean, in many ways, ethnic media is more cosmopolitan than mainstream media. It's global and local, for one thing. So we're stuck with language. We need new terms. We need new ways of thinking about things. So I would say that to the extent that ethnic media would be asking you to consider becoming student sources of reporting of essays, of photography, of videos, etc., it would be to better reflect the experiences of the communities they serve. And to if you think of environmentalism, it has such a Anglo kind of, most of the people I know who talk about or think about or write about the environment are not, the first people who come to mind are not the communities at the forefront of the costs of some of the environmental problems. But there's just not enough, If these audiences are the ones who care the deepest, but they're not getting information and they're not getting a sense of where they fit in the whole drama, arguably the biggest drama politically, I think, the one none of us has an answer for. It's so big because we've only just begun to think about it. I really think if you can open this field up, if you can help bring new content, storytelling, ideas, profiles of some of the people. I think to myself, if I could spend 2 weeks writing about ethnic restaurants and what they're doing to address some of the larger issues that we see of accessing healthier food, like you know, whenever I come to LA, I make for the Miyako Hotel, because opposite the Miyako is the best noodle house, one of the best I've found in California, and it's open until 12. It always has a huge crowd of people, and you guys probably know about it, although you're kind of far from it. And I would love to tell their view of how they're addressing environmental concerns. I'd love to do a whole spread on ethnic restaurants, because there's so much part of the urban landscape. A colleague of mine said he wanted to look at the clotheslines where people hang up their clothes to dry, that we always thought of as eyesores, and he wanted to use them as an example of environmental adaptation. Change the way we see what is out there. That's a very good example of it. I think what people would love. The Watts Times did a story about a soul food restaurant that had gone vegan, and that became the single most hit on story that week on our website. Nationally and internationally, it's just a soul food restaurant that was vegan in South Central. I mean, you'd think that was so minuscule, but people love that story.
Well, that's a great example of that something big in a small story and opening things up through food. And I think I'm sorry we're out of time, but that's a wonderful way to suggest about opening up the stories of the environment, coverage of the environment, and we'll continue that conversation on Thursday, and please join me in thanking Sandy for being here.